podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Top Order Podcast. On this episode, we're joined by another special guest, this time a man who's played over 80 games for the Black Caps, is the all-time leading run scorer for Canterbury, and is fresh off an incredible season in his first as coach of that same province. Peter Fulton, welcome to the Top Order Podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, it's our pleasure. Look, firstly, we must say a massive congrats on the season. We've touched on it a little in our recent review of the New Zealand domestic summer, but 4 out of 5 trophies for the Canterbury region this summer. The Magicians picked up both their titles. Your lads won the Plunkett Shield and the Ford Trophy. Of course, you always want to win it all when you start every season, but what were you expecting when you took on the role as coach of this Canterbury side?
I think you can't. It's easy to say you expect to win competitions, but you know there's six good teams in New Zealand who are all trying to win the same competition. So you don't, you know, you've only got so much control over the winning side of it, I suppose. But look, I think when I started the job, I believed that Canterbury had, you know, talented players and enough talented players to probably, you know, achieve better results than maybe what they had in the previous 2 or 3 seasons. So, like I said, While I expected that, you know, we'd be in contention to win some titles, I guess I just wanted to see, you know, probably improvement from the previous couple of years, and we certainly got that.
And in terms of your approach when you took on the job, was your sort of initial work with the guys all about establishing a culture and sort of setting the mould for how you wanted to shape that team? Or did you get immediately into the nitty-gritty, into techniques and strategies and all that kind of stuff? You know, I guess you hear coaches talking about starting up, watching a lot of film to get used to how the guys are operating. What were the key things for you coming into this role?
Well, I think I had a little bit of an advantage given that I played, you know, with or against, you know, just about all the guys in the squad. You know, and some of them I know a lot better than others, but yeah, you know, I guess I had an understanding of just about all of them. So for me, it was about not so much about working harder, but just working a little bit smarter. I think all those guys in the team have always had a good work ethic, but probably at the detriment sometimes to themselves, just, you know, thinking that if they hit more balls and bowl more balls, then they'll get better. And, you know, while there is a part of that in cricket, it's just about being a little bit smarter and probably working a little bit more on the mental side of the game. I think that's, you know, that's probably is the difference between the good players and the great players.
And I mean, yeah, you touched on it a little bit there, but I mean, what does day-to-day coaching look like for a head coach of a franchise? I've heard, you know, talking to a few of the boys, sounds like you do a lot of rugby refereeing.
Yep. You've got to referee the game of touch and warm-ups. So
I've heard you cop a decent spray from a few of the boys.
Oh, yeah, you cop a bit of a spray, but that's all right. Most of them are terrible touch players. So,
you want to name anyone in particular?
Oh, there's a few. Cam Fletcher is probably one of the worst touch players I've ever seen. you wouldn't have thought he grew up in New Zealand. It's a little bit embarrassing at times, but so the boys got to play touch every day. So that's the first thing. If you try to tell them they're not playing touch in the warm-ups before we get started, then you'll have a mutiny on your hands.
So. Oh, wow. So I guess what is the rest of your coaching setup look? You know, maybe a week or, you know, game day and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, I guess it just depends, really. I mean, in the pre-season, it's pretty structured. But once you get in the season and the games start rolling around, you have to be a little bit flexible, really, because depending on what happens in the game, for example, if it's a 4-day game, sometimes your bowlers might bowl a lot of overs, so 3 or 4 days before the next game they're probably actually only going to bowl once, if that. So likewise, if the game's rain affected or you don't happen to bowl a lot of overs, then it might be different. So you just got to be quite flexible, I think. And I think the players expect that they're going to turn up and everything's going to be organised. So, like I said, you can have the best laid plans, but that can all, you know, that can all change pretty quickly depending on what happens in the game and the weather and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it does vary, and that's probably part of it as well. You have to try and mix things up a little bit because, yeah, otherwise the players probably get a little bit bored and switch off.
How much of that sort of rest and load management nowadays is numbers driven, and how much of it is you're talking to the players and getting a feel for, you know, them getting a feel for their bodies and how they're travelling? And how much has that changed since you sort of started playing cricket a couple of years back?
Yeah, a couple of years back. When I started playing for Canterbury in about 2000, 2001, I don't really ever remember the bowlers talking about their loading and how many overs they bowled. They just would train, you know, maybe a couple of times a week at the old Lancaster Park, and the bowlers would bowl, the batters would bat. And you might see the odd person have throwdowns at the end of training, but not very often. It was just all bowlers. And yeah, now it's probably, you know, a little bit sort of gone the opposite, really. You'll see the bowlers bowling a little bit at training, but there's a lot of throws and there's a lot of the old dog flinger. It's just, I guess, and rightly so. I mean, there's a lot of people, probably older players, who would say, oh, it's, you know, back in my day, we just bowled and that's how we stayed fit. And, you know, that's probably true, but they didn't play the same amount of cricket, and they probably didn't play at the same intensity for as long. So
yeah, it's a good point.
You've got to look after the bowlers, because, you know, as we saw this year, the bowlers, especially in 4-day cricket, the bowlers are what wins you competition. So if you can keep your best bowlers on the park, then you're going to have a pretty good season.
And there's one bowler in particular I want to talk about in a second, but let's just take a little step back to, I guess, you taking on the Canterbury role, because, I mean, you were New Zealand batting coach at the time, and, I mean, the New Zealand setup at the moment seems like a great place to be. I mean, what was your main motivation to, I guess, step away from that role and take on the Canterbury gig?
Well, there's probably two. The main one was, I guess, I've always wanted to be a head coach, and it might seem like there's not a lot of difference between the head coach and the batting coach, but, you know, in a cricket team, but especially these days, the batting coach is, I guess, especially in the Black Caps environment, you know, you're probably a resource and you've got to throw a lot of balls and you've got to fling a lot of balls. And it's very much sort of, I guess, a hands-on. Most of the players, you know, especially the very good ones, are coming to you and saying, this is what I want to work on. Can you facilitate this for me? Whereas a head coach, there's a lot more planning that goes in. I guess you've got control over ultimately, you know, what happens and who's picked and who's not, those sort of things. So, I've always wanted to be, a head coach. So I sort of felt like if I stayed in that role with the Black Caps, which I really enjoyed, but if I stayed in that role, then I wasn't going to get experience as a head coach. And so it was sort of, a little bit of a case of right job at the right time. I got to combine being a head coach with being at home a little bit more often. I've got two young girls and, as the guys are about to find out this year and over the winter, the Black Cap guys, I think, you know, they're going to be away from mid-May, and apart from maybe 4 or 5 weeks in the middle of the year, they're going to be away till Christmas. So, yeah, awful long time to be away. So, like I said, good chance to combine those two reasons and be at home a bit more and be a head coach.
Yeah, it's staggering when you put it like that, how much time those guys are going to be away. I mean, I'm sure you probably still keep a pretty close eye on the Black Caps. I mean, what have you made of their summer so far?
Oh, well, I've played outstandingly well. And I think, I mean, to be fair, you'd probably expect a lot of those results. I think the T20 series against Australia was probably always going to be the big challenge. And, you know, it went sort of down to the wire. But the other teams, you'd probably, at the start of the year, you would have expected the Black Caps to dominate them. And I think that's a sign of how far the team's come, that, you know, especially at home when we play anyone other than probably Australia, you know, with the exception of them, I think at home, everyone else, we expect that we should win and beat convincingly.
And I mean, that Aussie tour, I mean, we, as New Zealand fans, I guess, that's I guess the one blip on the resume of the last couple of years. I mean, you were around the squad. I mean, do you kind of think about that tour and think kind of what happened? Because it feels like we just weren't able to, I guess, show what good side we are at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tough one. I think at the time, probably the feeling amongst the whole group and the team was that, you know, we just got beaten by a far better team in those conditions. But then later on, then when you saw later on when India went there and had a depleted team and, you know, obviously played so well against them, you sort of thought, well, if they can hold their own and they can win games over there, then why couldn't we? So, I think there's a few factors. I think the first one, I think from my point of view, I think if we had our time over again, I don't think those two test matches against England before we went actually did us any favours. Mm. We played on two really flat wickets at Mount Maunganui and Hamilton, and the bowlers had to bowl a lot of overs. We then pretty much went home for 3 days, jumped on a plane, flew to Perth, 8-hour time difference. A few guys arrived late, jet lag. You know, the training facilities were poor. It was 45 degrees every day. So it was almost like the perfect storm for how you wouldn't prepare for a test series. Mm. And we got smashed, obviously, in the first game. And Lachie Ferguson, unfortunately, got injured on debut. And from there, it spiraled. You know, with guys, I guess the confidence took a bit of a knock. Australia, I guess, sort of sensed that we were sort of probably a little bit down on confidence, and they jumped all over us.
Yeah, let's not dwell on that too much. Let's go back to Canterbury and the awesome season that you guys had. I mean, you talked about bowlers before. Will Williams is someone I'd really love to hear your thoughts on, because, I mean, he wasn't just the standout bowler for Canterbury, the standout bowler across the whole of the New Zealand domestic scene. We just had a review episode of the New Zealand summer, and we rattled off his stats. It's just incredible. But, you know, when you look at him, on the TV screen, he doesn't look especially threatening necessarily compared to some of the other bowlers around the scene. What is it about Will that, I guess, has led to having such success? And is he someone that could make that step up?
I mean, I think the thing about Will, probably I'd say his biggest asset is his self-confidence. Possibly, and I don't want this to come off the wrong way, but possibly even to the point where it doesn't make any sense how confident he is in his own ability.
Yeah.
Because as you say, he doesn't bowl very quick. He's not exactly the most, you know, menacing guy physically. But like I said, he's incredibly skillful. He's got an ability to swing the ball and to, I guess, present the seam so that it either nips in or it nips away. He's really fit. He's one of the fittest, be one of the fittest guys, you know, in New Zealand cricket. Really smart in terms of how he scouts opposition batsmen and his plans. You know, so like I said, he ticks a lot of boxes. And from when he made his first class debut, and I think some of the guys still enjoy giving him a bit of a hard time. I think he got given out handle ball on debut down in Dunedin.
That's right, yeah.
And he famously came off after the innings and said he didn't even know that was a rule, that you couldn't touch the ball with your hands when you're batting. So, yeah, like I said, he's probably exceeded my expectations of when I first played with him for Canterbury Country of what he would do. Mm. And as for how far he could go, like I said, I wouldn't put any limits on it, because, you know, probably people have been saying for the last 6 or 7 years that, you know, he'll never consistently play first class cricket, or he'll never consistently have success, and he just keeps proving them wrong.
Mm. And I mean, yeah, well, I think that you're absolutely right. And once you put those numbers up on the board, you sort of have to start getting a go. I mean, you mentioned it before as a dreadful touch player, but Cam Fletcher's had another one that's had an awesome season. I mean, we've played a bit of cricket up with him up here in Auckland, and I think he averaged about 80 in the Plunkett Shield. And yeah, it seemed like he was just getting better and better throughout the year. was that what you saw from a you know, in the squad perspective?
Yeah, well, I hadn't obviously I played with Fletch, and then sort of the last 2 or 3 years hadn't sort of seen too much of him. I've seen a little bit of bits and pieces, but yeah, his keeping's always been of a pretty good standard. I think it's probably his batting that was I guess needed to catch up, probably to sort of get him into sort of higher honours contention. Mm. And this year he's batted beautifully, and you know, 4 day cricket, he scored a lot of runs. T20s, he played that amazing knock in the semi final against Central Districts at Eden Park No. 2, and yeah, another guy who works incredibly hard, and is probably, again, you know, I didn't know him before he came to Canterbury, but there's probably a few people up in Auckland who are sort of looking at him now, and thinking, you know, geez, I didn't realise he was going to be quite such a good player, and they're probably also looking at him realising he wasn't going to be, you know, have the physique that he has now.
I've seen
some photos of him when he was 17 or 18, and the before and after, I'm sure the drug testers are probably you know, sniffing around Fletch every season just to make sure that it's actually as, you know, as good as it looks.
Yeah, it's been a running joke on the show for us, Cam's antics in the weight room. It started when he was up here, that little transformation from this tiny little man to the Hulk that he is now. So, but I mean, despite all of the stats from Cam about his batting, Ken McClure was the batter of the year for you guys. Probably someone that, you know, the average New Zealand Black Caps fan might not know about as well. Played an awesome knock in the Ford Trophy final. Maybe just a touch of a word on Ken.
Yeah, well, Ken, he's been, you know, played New Zealand under-19s. He's down in Canterbury. He's always been, he was a guy probably going back 9 or 10 years who, when I was still playing, that, you know, when you start hearing talk about guys who are sort of at high school, that he was a guy that everyone was talking about how talented he was, and, you know, how, you know, he's got these amazingly fast hands. So, yeah. Probably took a while to, I think he probably took a wee while to work out that cricket was actually sort of what he wanted to do and you know, take it really seriously. But he's also had, I think, you know, we played a Ford Trophy final at Pukekura Park about 4 or 5 years ago, and he actually suffered a really serious hip injury. He sort of almost dislocated his hip and snapped off part of his hip effectively.
Jeez.
I'm sure I'm not getting that exactly right, but yeah, it was a really serious injury to the point where they weren't sure if he was ever going to be able to play again. So, yeah, he's sort of fought through that. Got hit in the head a couple of times 2 or 3 years ago, concussion again, fought through that, you know, and this year he's been outstanding. He's played, especially in the one-day comp, played some amazing innings. And as you say, the game against the final against Northern Districts, you know, it's probably testament to how well he played that he actually almost sort of overshadowed Henry Nicholls, yeah, you know, at times in that inning. So that shows how talented he is.
You mentioned the New Zealand under-19 program. Cam got a few runs for the New Zealand A side over the course of the summer, I think, going back to the West Indies series. The New Zealand A program and the under-19 and under-23 kind of setups that New Zealand have now, How does that kind of impact the depth in your squad and the depth of the New Zealand sort of squads as a whole? Because I kind of feel like, looking from the outside, there's never been greater depth in New Zealand cricket at the moment. We've got all these guys that are coming in and doing a job for New Zealand over the course of the summer. I mean, you talk about Finn Allen, you talk about Jacob Duffy did a great job, Devin Conway as well, and now we've seen Rachin Ravindra selected in the test side. For you as a coach, how important, and particularly in your role as a Black Caps batting coach, how important was that NZA program in terms of bridging the gap between provincial cricket and that sort of international level cricket?
Yeah, well, I think you're right when you say the depth's probably never been so good. When you look at the players who have come in this year, you know, the likes of Will Young and Devin Conway, Finn Allen, I think, one, that's a good sign that domestic cricket is doing a really good job and producing players who are able to step up. Mm. The New Zealand A program, I think, is a little bit like a finishing school.
Mm.
So you get these guys who play domestic cricket who perform really well, Black Cap selectors think, yep, I think this guy's, you know, probably pretty close to playing, or we're definitely interested. Go and play NZA, hopefully has some success, and that sort of, I guess, just gives them that last little bit of confidence that, yeah, this guy's ready. You know, and then, as you say, like, you know, the guys that have come in this year just haven't looked out of place at all. Daryl Mitchell, again, another one who has come in and not just done okay, but actually dominated at times. So I think that's a really good sign for, like I said, it's a good sign for the Black Caps, good sign for domestic cricket. I guess a good sign for the whole system that it seems to be producing quality players.
Yeah, Daryl Mitchell's a really interesting one for me because it feels like he's been around for years now. But you're right. I think, did he make his debut this season for New Zealand?
Played test last year, and then one day debut this year.
So like he feels to me like he's been a guy who's been around for years and years and years, and he's only just sort of come through that system. Peter, what was it like for you when you first came into the New Zealand setup as a player? Did you have that same kind of grounding in A cricket and that kind of exposure to the kind of higher honour stuff, or did you sort of go straight from domestic cricket into the national side?
No, I came through the A system as well. I had probably a couple of good seasons for Canterbury, and then I went on a NZA tour to South Africa, which probably for my career was a real eye-opener. The standard was way higher, you know, way higher than what I'd been playing in New Zealand. And I guess a really sort of hard style of cricket, you know, fast, bouncy pitches, quick bowlers, you know, a lot of verbal abuse, probably. So yeah, like I said, a real eye opener. And I probably didn't realise at the time, but I was probably sort of, that was probably what was happening then is what happens now. I'd probably been identified by the selectors as someone who they were interested in. So they thought, let's send him on this A tour and, you know, effectively see how he goes. And I had some success, and then I sort of started, I guess, or got picked for New Zealand shortly after that. So, yeah, I think that A program's been around for a while. And look, it's a financial thing. I think nowadays that the A programs are almost always in New Zealand because it's cheaper for teams to come here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was, I went to South Africa, and then the next year we went to Sri Lanka. And yeah, for my career, they were, you know, really cool experiences because you play in some foreign conditions and just, I guess, allows you to get accustomed to what you're going to face at you know, at the highest level.
Who were the South African bowlers on that tour, the ones that were giving you all the stick?
Who were the bowlers? There was a guy, LB Morkel. Oh, yeah. It was the brother of Mornay Morkel. He wasn't quite as quick. There was a guy, there was another guy, Garnet Kruger, who played for South Africa. Alfonso Thomas. I think most of them ended up playing for South Africa. Mm. But yeah, it was ruthless. It was absolutely ruthless. So yeah, like I said, a really good eye opener. And also, just like I said, playing in South Africa, it's a place obviously New Zealanders probably struggled to win games in the history of, you know, Test cricket. So great place to tour. And I was thinking I was about 23, 24, and yeah, it'd still be one of the, you know, more enjoyable tours I've been on.
And it wasn't long after those tours that you were selected to play for New Zealand. Obviously, a very special moment for every New Zealander to represent their country. Can you talk us through what your experience of your debut was like? Who gave you your cap? Do you remember much of the game, or did it all pass sort of in a blur of emotion?
I got picked to go on a one-day tour of Bangladesh in 2005, or 2004, sorry. And I remember I remember the test team were already over there, so we flew over for the one-dayers. And luckily, there was a few Canterbury guys going over just for the one-dayers. I think Chris Cairns and Chris Harris, Craig McMillan, I think there was a few guys. And yeah, it was first time in business class, so that was a real highlight. For anyone who's flown in business class, we'll tell you. So that was a highlight, but got to Bangladesh. You know, it took about 40 hours to get there, middle of the night, almost died three times on the way to the hotel in the car. The hotel, fairly average at best. I was sort of thinking, shit, what have I got myself into here? This is, you know, this isn't quite what it's cracked up to be. I think I had egg fried rice for about the whole 3 weeks I was there because I was petrified of getting food poisoning because sure. everyone had told me that subcontinent you just get sick. The power went off 10 times a day, but still an amazing experience. Like, yeah, to make my debut, it just went into blur, to be honest. Went in an absolute blur. I couldn't tell you who gave me my cap or anything like that. I just remember being told I was playing. It was about 40 degrees. I think I was open with Nathan Astle. I remember that. I hit my first two balls for four. And then I think I got bowled and we almost lost the game.
Yeah.
So that's good that at least we didn't lose because in those days, obviously playing Bangladesh was, you know, losing to them would have been a massive no-no. So especially over there, but yeah, great experience. And it was probably, it probably didn't quite compare to playing when I came back to New Zealand the following year and we played in New Zealand. It was, you know, seemed a bit more real because family and friends were there, but still, like I said, an amazing experience.
I read somewhere that you were Canterbury Country's first international player. I feel like that can't be true.
First person to, I guess, play for New Zealand while they were playing for Canterbury Country. John Wright. John Wright was obviously from Canterbury Country, but he didn't, you know, he didn't play for Canterbury Country. So I think I was the first. Henry Nichols was the second. So yeah, hopefully at some stage someone else will come along and, you know, we'll have a third.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, going through your playing career a year, we've got to kind of touch on, particularly because I've got an Australian standing right next to me, 2007, that Chapel Hadley series. I mean, we don't often get wins against Australia. We just talked about how tough that tour was. You played the final two games of that ODI series and we chased down 330 plus, I think, in both those games. I mean, what are your memories from those games? And I guess being in the middle when you're chasing such a big score, because, I mean, teams just 330 is nothing nowadays, it seems, but like back then it was a massive score.
Yeah. I mean, we'd been over in Australia just before that playing in the tri series with England and Australia, and we'd sort of just missed out on making the finals. So we'd come home. I got dropped actually. And so for the first game was at the Cake Tin. I think that was the one we bowled Australia out for about 170 and Stephen Fleming and Lou Vincent knocked it off, none down.
Yep.
So I was actually at the pub with some mates and just watching it. And I think Jacob Oram took a catch and broke his finger. Mm. And at the end of the game, I had a text message on my phone from the manager saying, "Oh, you need to ring me." So I sort of went outside and rung him and tried not to sort of slur too much. And he said, Jake's broken his finger, so you're coming up to Auckland tomorrow, you know, for the game on Sunday.
Nice.
Because this was Friday night. And so, yeah, so I sort of had to sober up pretty quickly and go inside and tell my mates that I was going home, and obviously got abused for that. And went up to Eden Park and we chased. I think they got 340 and the ball was flying all over the place. And we got off to a reasonable start, but we'd lost a few wickets and started a partnership with Ross Taylor. And that was, for people who remember, that was sort of like Ross Taylor's sort of real, I guess, sort of innings that sort of really kick-started his international career. And he got a great 100, and Craig McMillan played a really great knock as well, came out and whacked it. And we sort of, before you know it, we'd won the game. And it probably didn't really sink in at the time because we had a game that was Sunday. We had a game on the Tuesday as well, and same thing happened. Australia won the toss and they got 350 and we lost a few early wickets and Craig McMillan whacked it again, and Brendan McCullum played a great knock. And yeah, I've seen the highlights of the game a few times during lockdown. They were on a couple of times, and there was moments that I'd sort of forgotten, like Mark Gillespie.
Yeah,
he got about 30 off about 15 balls, and French cut about three past the keeper. And yeah, it was one of those sort of series where just bizarre. Everything sort of strange was happening. But we managed to get the win in Hamilton, and to beat Australia 3-0 at that stage was like, you know, was an amazing achievement. And in hindsight, probably it didn't help us going to that World Cup, because we probably thought we were a little bit better than what we were, to be honest.
Yeah, so let's get to that World Cup. I mean, you're saying you guys thought, so I guess going into that, maybe that gives you the confidence to feel like you could win, because I remember watching that as a fan and thinking we were a bit of a chance. And even I remember really not wanting to play Sri Lanka in the semi-final. I can't even remember why I didn't want us to match up against Sri Lanka, but for some reason thought we were a really bad matchup against them. I mean, yeah, I guess you guys obviously thought you were a good chance for that tour, and then, like, do you guys have those thoughts of, like, we just definitely do not want Sri Lanka or Aussie or whoever in a tournament like that?
No, I think we beat South Africa, and with two games to go, or a game to go in the round robin, or the Super Eights or whatever it was called back then, and so that meant we knew we were in the semis, and we had to play Australia in our last game, but we already knew we were in the semi final, and we got hammered. They got 330 and bowled us out for about 150, and I think when I think about it in hindsight, I think it was the sort of game I think we went into it just thinking, oh well, we're in the semi, so it doesn't actually matter, like, you know. Whereas I think Australia, probably on the back of that 3-0 defeat in New Zealand, were like, we're going to smash them and we're going to go into the semi-finals with a lot of momentum. So we got hammered, and then we went to Jamaica, I don't remember anyone sort of thinking we don't want to play Sri Lanka. I think we sort of fancied our chances against them, because we'd played them in two series at home in the previous 2 years and done pretty well. So I think we were pretty confident. You know, and again, I think the highlights were on, and we're on a lockdown, and, you know, there's a couple of moments in the game where we, you know, dropped a couple of catches, and they probably got 30 or 40 more than they should have. You know, and then, yeah, we were sort of going not too bad at one stage, and then Muralitharan got about three wickets in the space of two overs, and then all of a sudden, before you knew it, the game was over, and we were, you know, sitting in the sheds just thinking, shit, what happened?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the big things about that tour, that World Cup, I remember them just talking about how long it went on for, and ages and ages and ages, like in the media. We had a chat with Jeetan Patel a couple of months ago, and he was saying it was a pretty fun one for you guys off the field.
Yeah. No, like I said, it was long, but it was good. It was good. Trust me. The people who were there, I don't think anyone, we have like 7 days in between games. And there's probably, in those days, well, especially in the West Indies, the training facilities weren't great. So you're obviously 7 days in between games. You're not going to train for 7 days straight before a game. So, again, you go to the West Indies, there's not a lot else to do other than go to the beach or go to the pub. So, it was a great trip. I loved every minute of it. And people, yeah, you'd read stuff in the media about people saying, hey, it was terrible World Cup and it went too long and it was boring. But, yeah, I had a great time. I had a great time.
There we go. Note for the ICC, make World Cups fractionally longer with more downtime for the players, and they'll enjoy it. I think that's a formula for success for everyone. For you, Peter, in the years after the World Cup, you had some success in the Black Cap side. You were in and out across the formats. What was it like for you when you were on that fringe of the team? You know, did you ever have in the back of the mind, well, one low score here or a couple of low scores across a couple of formats, and I might find myself on the outside looking in again? How did you prepare for games, and how did you feel about your career when you were going through that kind of phase?
Yeah, I think that's the probably the hard part for any player, because every player goes through those periods. And I always think, I mean, the difference between the, you know, the decent players and the great players, the great players have those thoughts, but it might only last two innings or three innings, you know, whereas for other guys, if it lasts 7, 8, 9, 10 innings, that's when you start to find yourself under some real pressure. So, yeah, I mean, after that World Cup, the next couple of years, I had some issues with my knee, and that probably took a bit of its toll, and found myself probably in that situation where it was like, you know, you go into a series and think, you know, if I don't score runs here, I'm in trouble. Mm. And I ended up getting dropped, getting left out after a series against Pakistan in New Zealand, 2009, I think it was. And yeah, then I had basically the best part of sort of three or four years out of the team just playing for Canterbury. Mm. And you do, I guess, start to think, well, maybe I'm not gonna get picked again. So after a while, I was sort of just like, well, if I don't get picked, I don't get picked. It doesn't really matter. I'm still enjoying playing for Canterbury and still got a pretty cool job doing this. So, you know, and ironically, that was when I had probably, you know, one of the best seasons of my career and it actually ended up getting picked for New Zealand again. So, yeah, it's probably, you know, there's probably a lesson in there somewhere about, you know, the pressure that you put on yourself and whether it actually helps or not.
Mm. Yeah, well, that 2013 season was a huge resurgence for you. I was at that test at Eden Park, 100 in each innings against England. You know, you brought up, I think, Stuart, were you saying you brought up 100 with a straight six down the ground? I mean, how good was that for you to come back into the side and then, you know, ton up against the old foe in both innings?
Yeah, it was great. I'd come in for that was the third test of the series, and I'd got a couple of 50s in the first two games and had to, you know, I guess probably felt like I had to really sort of just grind them out and, you know, probably wasn't overly pretty, but found a way to get a couple of scores. So so I was feeling all right going into that game. And, the first innings, first 100 was pretty slow and just a real, like I said, just trying to find a way to get the job done. And then the second innings, we were obviously trying to set up the game and looking to get some quick runs. So I guess I could probably express myself and play a few shots. And my mum and dad had come up on the fourth morning. I was not out overnight the night before, and they said they were going to come up. And I was like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, yeah. Honestly, just, you know, I could get out in the first over, so don't waste your time. But they wanted to come up. I think they felt guilty because they missed the first one. Mm. Got to play some shots, and that's probably, you know, not often in a test match you actually get to just go out and bat and actually not actually even worry if you get out, because there's no pressure. Most of the time there's just pressure the whole time. So you had to play some shots and get a few over the rope was a good feeling. And I copped a fair bit during the series from some of the English bowlers. So it was nice to, it was nice to dish out a bit of stick in return and have some fun.
Yeah, good on you. I do remember you. Did you open the batting in both innings of that test? And how much of an adjustment was that for you to open the batting in a test match, particularly getting recalled into that New Zealand squad? Or did that sort of, at that stage of the career, did that sort of step up to opening the batting feel quite naturally and quite comfortable for you?
I'd done it the whole season for Canterbury and some of the season before. Yeah. So we'd had a few different guys sort of come into the team, and we didn't have an opener. So at that stage I was batting three and I was the captain. So I just said, oh, well, I'll just open, because, you know, it didn't really worry me where I batted at that point in time. So it wasn't too much of an adjustment. The longer I played, I actually quite enjoyed opening the batting, because at least it gave you some sort of certainty over what was happening. There's obviously a lot of variables in cricket, but opening the batting, at least there's some certainty that you know that, you know, once the toss is done, there's a 50% chance that you're going to be batting at, you know, 10:30. So, yeah, I quite enjoyed it after a while. And a lot of the time I found myself hoping, sort of secretly hoping, that we were going to bat first. Even if, you know, we wanted to bowl first, I just wanted to sometimes bat first, just because at least then you knew that, you knew what was going to happen. You're out there and you can get into it.
And look, this is a random question, but one of our listeners has a really vivid memory, apparently, of you smashing one into your pad at some stage in a test match and not reviewing. Did that happen? And if so, I guess, was the team just under strict orders that, like, only Brendan could use the reviews? What happened there?
Yeah, I think that was towards the end of Brendan's career. That was definitely the case. I think no one else was allowed to use one. That was in Dunedin. That was against Pakistan. It was actually just before I got dropped. It was in the second innings. It was the first series anywhere where they'd used DRS. And it wasn't quite what they had now. They basically just had you know, like a replay. They just had a replay of the ball. I don't think they had hot. Not sure if they had hotspot. They might have had Snicko, but I don't think they had hotspot. And I was first or second ball, and I sort of inside edge one, and I thought got given out, and I sort of thought, shit, have I inside edge that? Maybe I haven't. And I thought, well, shit, what if I review it and it's not out and it's, you know, and I haven't hit it, then I've wasted one. And then before I sort of knew it, I just, nah, I won't. And then I walked off. And by the time I got off, I sort of knew. I thought, shit, I've cocked that up.
Yeah.
Whereas now, it's sort of second nature in international cricket. People just burn them left, right and centre.
Mm.
So if I had my time again, yeah, I would have just, I definitely, obviously, would have just been, oh well, I won't worry about it. If I get it wrong, I get it wrong.
Yeah, just give it the old Tim Payne straight away.
The first series, I sort of, I don't know, I was trying to be too much of a team player and just make sure I didn't waste one. I should have been a bit more selfish and just said, nah, bugger it.
and I mean, you said before, after your New Zealand career, you still went back and played a lot more for Canterbury. Went on to become the highest run scorer ever for the province. We've talked to Toddy Astle a few months ago, actually, I think during lockdown, and he said that being the leading wicket taker for Canterbury was actually quite a big motivation for him and a really special moment. Is it similar for you for the run scoring stuff?
It was a pretty, I guess it was when I broke the record, it was a pretty cool feeling because I'd sort of grown up, you know, going down to Lancaster Park and watching Canterbury. And I remember when I started and you'd sort of have a look at through some of the records and you sort of thought, shit, that's a long way away. I think it was 6,500 runs. So you never really sort of think that that's going to be possible. It was definitely a cool feeling. I don't think it was necessarily a motivating factor. I think probably if anything, it was, you know, statistics were more important to me when I was younger. As I got older, towards the end of my career for Canterbury, I just wanted to try and win games and try and win some titles before I finished. So, yeah, like I said, definitely cool when I look back. I look back now, you know, some of the names on the list, some of the people I sort of went past, I think that's pretty cool. And, you know, hopefully some of the guys in the team at some stage now will, you know, in a few years' time, you know, we'll be able to break some of those records and, you know, knock me down into second place.
And the one thing that did stand out for me when I looked at your first class record, 11 wickets, and including a forfer. What do you even bowl? What did you bowl?
Is it only 11? I thought it was 13. Is it 13? I thought it was 13.
Well, you have
13.
To take that up with the good people at Crick Info. They've got it horribly wrong.
It's somewhere around there. when I first started, I used to bowl medium pace. And I probably bowled, oh, I bowled them, well, I think I got all those wickets in my first probably two seasons for Canterbury. I got 7 wickets in a match, one game for Canterbury at Kiwi 2. Pretty flat wicket in those days, so 7 wickets is a pretty good effort. Some of the young guys in the team now can't believe it because they've never seen me bowl. But yeah, I bowled a bit of medium pace, and then I had, like I said earlier, I had some problems with my knees, and then after a couple of years, probably once I'd cemented my spot in the team, and I didn't have to rely on the bowling as a way of getting inside, then I knocked it on the head and said, I don't need to worry anymore. But I really enjoyed my bowling. I used to, every time I'd go to England, play club cricket, always make sure you bowl over there because you're normally on some sort of bonus for wickets and stuff like that. So always make sure you roll your arm over in England.
Yeah, the amount of part-time off-spinners going around the England club scene remarkable.
Exactly.
So sort of post-career, you moved into coaching. You were in charge of the New Zealand under-19s in 2018. That seemed like a pretty good crop of players you had there. You had Finn Allen, Ruchin Ravindra, a whole host of other guys that we're starting to see on the domestic circuit now as well. Was Calum in that squad as well that's now involved in the Canterbury setup?
Yeah, Calum Boshier was in that, the Chiefs player.
Yeah. Nice of him to deliver a few on a good length in that Black Clash game a couple of months back as well, get you going.
Yeah, it was. He was actually, before he came on to bowl, he was doing a bit of trash talking, actually, telling me that he was that when he came on, he was gonna get me out. So when he came on, I thought, okay, well, you know, you've asked for it. So yeah, it was nice to get one over him. I think he's definitely chosen the right career going with the rugby. Seriously, he was a really talented cricketer. And I'm sure he would have played, you know, he definitely would have played for first class cricket at some stage for CD if he'd stuck with cricket. You know, and then after that, who knows? But yeah, nice to get a few runs. All I wanted to do in that game was actually just probably get double figures. Because I hadn't played at all since I retired. Haven't played a game of cricket at all. So yeah, the main motivation was just make sure you get double figures and not completely embarrass yourself.
Yeah, it looked like you, as soon as he came on to bowl, some kind of competitive switch flicked in you, and you kind of had that sort of 1,000-yard stare, and he bowled the first full toss and it disappeared, and I was sort of sitting there watching it going, oh, hello, Peter Fulton flicked a switch here. Anything could happen, and it did. It was fantastic to watch. Speaking of young guys, lots of young New Zealand cricketers are on the scene. Who are the guys in that Canterbury setup that are coming through the ranks that we should be on the lookout for sort of leading into next season and seasons beyond?
The Canterbury under 19 team, they won the national tournament last year, so there's a lot of good players. It's really hard. I don't want to give away too many secrets because might try and poach them. there's a few. I mean, I think off the top of my head, you know, there's a couple of there's a young bowler, Angus Sidey, who went to Christchurch Boys High, which is, you know, for people who sort of know their Christchurch or Canterbury cricket, will know has produced a lot of really good players over the years. He's a really promising fast bowler. Matt Boyle, who's the younger brother of Jack Boyle, who plays for Canterbury. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a really talented left-handed top order batsman. So there's a couple of names. I mean, I probably know this from my own experience. So I only made the Canterbury under 19 team for the national tournament at the last minute when someone else got injured and pulled out. So I wasn't originally selected. So I know more than anyone else that, what you do at 17, 18, 19 doesn't necessarily correspond with what you're going to do when you're 24 or 25. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to wait and see. Like I said, there's a lot of good young players in Canterbury. There's a lot of good players, you know, in that Canterbury squad at the moment who are going to be saying, well, you know, if you want to make this team, you're going to have to, you know, be doing something special to, you know, to take my spot. So that's, I guess, as a coach, that's what you want. You want a whole lot of guys who are just really competitive and want to do well and want to get better. And if you have that, then hopefully the cream will rise to the top.
And before we wrap things up, we'll get you to talk about someone from a different province then that you had a bit to do with in that 19 squad. Ratchan Ravindra, obviously just been picked for the New Zealand side. He's done really well in the New Zealand A, sort of had a mixed season for Wellington injury and all that other stuff, but definitely looks like someone with a lot of talent. Where do you kind of see him fitting in that New Zealand squad and in the years to come?
He's a really talented player, and I remember when I saw him in the under 19s, you know, he didn't come as any surprise. Like, he'd been on New Zealand cricket's radar for a few years, I think. So, you know, this has been coming for a while, and he probably just needed one sort of good season or some good performances for Wellington and then New Zealand A, which he's done this year. But I think he's a top order batsman who can bowl some good left arm spin. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think there's a chance he might play in England, to be honest. If I had to guess, I'd say especially the first test or the first couple of tests before the IPL guys get there, I think there's a good chance he might play. Because I think what he does, by being able to bowl left-arm spin and bat in the top six, he gives them the option of being able to play, you know, five batters, BJ Watling at six, maybe an all-rounder like Daryl Mitchell at seven, and then still play four fast bowlers. So he just gives them that balance to the team. So I think there's a good chance he could play, and I think definitely when they go to the subcontinent and play in India later on in the year, I think again having someone in your top six that can bowl spin, you know, is going to be massive. And look, I think I have no doubt that maybe whether it's this year or next year or whatever, at some stage, he's going to get an opportunity. And you know, he's a really talented player. And once he gets going in international cricket, then I'm sure he's going to have a long career.
Peter, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you for joining us on the Top Order podcast. Before we let you go, we'll just do a quick rundown of some quickfire questions, if you don't mind. We have got one second to last. The penultimate question is about the best sledge that you've been involved with on the cricket field. So given that you've named a couple of nations that gave you a bit of stick while you're batting, there's an opportunity for you to get your own back there. But let's start off with your favourite innings as a batter.
Favourite innings? I don't know. Probably either one of the hundreds against England at Eden Park, or else probably the game we talked about earlier, the Chapel Hadley game at Eden Park, when we chased 340. I got 70 odd not out, so to walk off, there was probably 25,000 people there that day, so to walk off in front of a crowd like that, having been there at the end when we hit the winning runs, was pretty special.
And of your 11 or 13, depending on whether or not CricInfo's got it right or wrong, we'll clarify that after the interview. Of those 13 wickets, which one was your favourite?
Oh, probably Ross Taylor.
Oh, yes, that's a good one to have in the bag.
I got Ross Taylor, just a sort of outswinger on off stump, just shaped away, and he just sort of poked at it and just feathered one through the keeper. So I'd definitely have to say Ross Taylor.
Superb. Favourite place to tour overseas?
Probably England or South Africa.
Nice.
England or South Africa.
Nice. Yeah. And who's the best teammate to have with you when you're rooming on tour?
Oh, well, if you're rooming on tour with the Black Caps, then you don't want to have any roommates because you want to have your own room. So, yeah, look, I didn't room with them that often, but you talked about him before, Jeetan Patel. Jeetan Patel's always pretty entertaining on a tour away.
And who's the pest that you found the most annoying to tour with? there's one in every squad. It's usually me, but who's the pest that you found really sort of got under your skin?
Well, when he started playing for New Zealand, Tim Southee's nickname was the Pest, because he just wouldn't stop talking, and he was sort of straight off the farm from Northland, and just, you know, had no just completely unstreetwise and no common sense, and just an absolute nightmare to sort of be around in general.
Superb. Are you a superstitious man? Do you have any superstitions when you're preparing to bat or preparing for a game?
Oh, no, not really superstitions. No, I used to always ask the umpire how many to come in the over when there was two balls left, even if I knew there was two balls.
Yep.
I'd just have to ask the umpire. So,
yep, nice one. And now that you're a coach, do you subscribe to the Wayne Bennett theory of having two motivational speeches, one for when you're winning and one for when you're losing, or do you work on your kind of motivational speeches and tactics for the dressing room?
Probably my biggest achievement in coaching so far is this season. I didn't really ever have to give the boys a spray.
Nice.
At any stage. So, like I said, probably a product of the fact that we were winning a lot of games. But, I didn't have to give them a real spray, or what I would consider a real spray. So hopefully keep that up my sleeve. You know, hopefully won't have to use it at some stage. But if I do, then I'll make sure it's a goodie.
Nice. Nice. Here's the big moment. Best sledge that you've been involved with on the cricket field, either one that you've been able to dish out to a fast bowler, or one that you've received?
I haven't dished too many out myself. I wouldn't say it's the best. Probably the most memorable one that I've ever had. Andre Nell, who used to play for South Africa, he once told me that he was going to bowl a bouncer and put the ball between the grill in my helmet and hit me between the eyes and kill me.
Wow.
So, which I didn't think was, you know, obviously that appropriate, especially it was it was pretty graphic.
That's very graphic.
But I think I think in hindsight he's probably had a few issues, I think, since he finished playing cricket, so that possibly explained why he was so angry.
Yes, he certainly was an angry man, I remember.
He was not one to be messed with. And Peter, again, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you for joining us on the show. Last question. What's been your proudest moment reflecting back on your playing career and now as a coach?
Proudest. I think probably the fact that I came, you know, played out in Canterbury Country, grew up out there at a time when people from Canterbury Country, you know, didn't really ever get picked for Canterbury, let alone picked for New Zealand. So to do that and then I guess be the sort of the first one, so to speak, and then now see other guys come through and sort of do it and know that, you know, you sort of played a part and I guess setting the stage for some other guys is probably one of the things I'm sort of probably most proud of.
Fantastic, and a great way to finish the podcast. Peter Fulton, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast. Congratulations on your victorious season with Canterbury and all the best for the future.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me.